From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. November 11th, 2017 marked 99 years since Poland became independent. On that day, while the government marked official Independence Day celebrations, elsewhere in the Polish capital of Warsaw, an estimated 60,000 protesters marched. They demanded a white Europe and denigrated Muslims, immigrants, and refugees while burning red flares. Although less than 1% of Poland's population is Muslim, the nation that suffered greatly under Nazi Germany during World War II has now ironically become the epicenter of anti-immigrant sentiment in Europe. But across Europe, from France, UK, Norway, the Netherlands, and beyond, the pushback from white Europeans against the world's largest global refugee crisis has been fueled by politicians, exacerbated by the failures of capitalism, and even encouraged by Donald Trump's white supremacism across the Atlantic. The author of a new book on European anti-immigrant sentiments worries that the problem lies not with outsiders coming to Europe, but the continent's internal forces that are jeopardizing the democratic ideals of openness and human rights for all. Sasha Polakow-Suransky is author of The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa. He's also an Open Society Foundation's fellow. He was an op-ed editor at the New York Times and a senior editor at Foreign Affairs. He now joins me to discuss his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. Welcome to the program, Sasha.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
So this issue seems to not be as relevant to the U.S. or seemed to not be as relevant to the U.S. until Donald Trump became president here. And his administration, officials in his administration and his supporters often point to Europe as leading the way in pushing back against immigration. Let's start with what happened in Poland in November 2017. I mentioned that 60,000 people marched. Some people say that march was taken over by white nationalists, but the main message seemed to be, let's keep Europe white. That, I understand, is one of the most largest recent sort of public demonstrations against immigration. How do you explain why this is happening in Poland?
Well, I think that Poland has a long and disturbing history of xenophobic sentiment. It was the site of some of the most brutal concentration camps during the Holocaust, and prior to the Nazi conquest, there was rampant anti-Semitism in Poland, and there still is quite rampant anti-Semitism in Poland. Among the slogans at this rally that you've referred to, yes, there were slogans about a pure white Europe, pure blood. There were also anti-Semitic slogans reviving some of the nastiest anti-Semitism in Polish and Eastern European history. And as you mentioned earlier, there was also nasty Islamophobia that was not even disguised. One of the other slogans on a sign at the rally was praying for an Islamic Holocaust. And in the land of Auschwitz, that's a pretty disturbing thing to see. And as you mentioned, Poland and other Eastern European countries have hardly any Muslim immigrants. And so the fact that these sentiments exist in a country like that shows how effective the political messaging has been from the far right, not just in Poland, but from across the continent. You have Viktor Orban in Hungary, who's no fan of liberal democracy and has been quite open in voicing that sentiment. And you have far-right leaders in Western Europe, like Geert Wilders in Holland or Marine Le Pen in France, who have been pushing a similar agenda. I think that they're a little bit more circumspect, if you can describe their rhetoric that way. It's quite overt in its xenophobia and anti-immigrant sentiment, but not quite as violent and direct as some of those signs you saw in Poland. But the idea is the same throughout Europe and at rallies like this that we've seen in the United States, in Charlottesville, or more recently in Florida. The sentiment is that Muslims are coming, they are replacing us, and that in 10 or 20 years, we'll all be speaking Arabic or Turkish rather than German or French. And these ideas are moving across the Atlantic, and there's a sort of cross-pollination going on, I think, between the far right in Europe and the far right in the United States. And you know, we saw a few hundred white supremacists in Charlottesville and many multiples of that in Poland.
Now, Germany is ironically one of the most immigrant-friendly places in Europe, especially policy-wise. Germany, because of its history during World War II, has taken great pains to say never again. We're never going to go back to that. So it's really interesting. I mean, for those of us who aren't experts in how European countries have evolved since World War II, how do you explain that difference, that Germany has tried hardest to welcome immigrants because it sees the echoes of what happened during World War II, whereas Poland has gone the other way?
Yeah, I think it's an important distinction. And you're right that Germany has very publicly sought to distance itself from its Nazi past. And so there's been a very public effort for decades to repudiate that history. And being nostalgic for the 1940s or the 1930s in modern Germany is simply off limits in a way that it's not in countries like Poland or even countries like France. You see this sort of nostalgia for that era across Eastern Europe, but also in countries like France and Holland, which were under Nazi occupation, or in the French case, under collaborationist Vichy rule. And there is a nostalgia in current public rhetoric for that period, as sort of looking back on it as if it was some sort of rosy past that we could go back to. And I find that incredibly frightening, given what happened to French Jews during the Vichy era, given what happened to Dutch Jews who were completely exterminated during the World War II era, and the fact that you have certain people speaking about that period as if it's something worth restoring is very worrying. So in that sense, Germany has been a model, but you know, it is coming back now, Sonali. This has been off limits for a long time, but what you see with groups like Pegida in Germany, they are starting to bring that nostalgia that was off limits for so long back into the public debate. And they're even politicians within this new far-right party in Germany, the Alternative for Deutschland, or the AfD as it's known in its abbreviated form, there's a leading politician who has not yet been expelled from that party, and he openly said a few months ago that the Holocaust Memorial in Berlin was a monument of shame. And yet a party that won 13% in Germany's most recent election hasn't managed to expel him and repudiate that kind of rhetoric. So it is coming back in Germany, but it's less mainstream and less acceptable.
I want to focus on France for a bit, because a lot of what has happened in France has impacted elsewhere in Europe. France is also the place that a 90-something-year-old author named Jean Raspail hails from. He wrote a book in 1973, so more than 40 years ago, called The Camp of the Saints, that you write about in your book, which has started to enjoy the sort of resurgent popularity among the far right, both in Europe and in the US. Ironically, that book focused on hordes of Indian Hindus invading Europe, but in the minds of white supremacists and racists, I suppose, if you're brown-skinned, you're all the same. Tell us about The Camp of the Saints and how we're seeing, not just in France, but elsewhere, this book and its ideals, or it's the sort of fear factor that it brings, being used to whip up anti-immigrant sentiment.
Yeah, The Camp of the Saints is incredibly important. And Jean Raspail, who wrote it in 1973, has become a sort of hero to far-right politicians and activists. During the Trump campaign, Steve Bannon constantly cited the book. Whenever he talked about the refugee crisis in Europe, he would say, this is a Camp of the Saints situation. We've reached a Camp of the Saints moment. In France, it's better known. And it's a reference that more people grasp immediately. And Marine Le Pen, who's actually known the author since she was 2 years old, because the author is very good friends with her father, she tweeted out to all of her millions of followers at the height of the refugee crisis in late 2015, read Raspail, read Camp of the Saints. Europe is being submerged by refugees. And so the message of that novel, in which the heroes shoot down refugees who are trying to come ashore or ram their boats at sea, that is being presented as a model, that is being presented as heroic by leading politicians and leading advisors, or a former leading advisor to the president of this country. And so if you're familiar with the novel and who it celebrates and who it denounces, it's a very, very disturbing model for any sort of refugee policy or migration policy in Europe, but it's being openly celebrated by quite a number of people on the far right.
And so in France, we've seen not just what has happened to refugees, for example, in the refugee camp Calais or the jungle, which was burnt down by police, but also some of the attacks, the terrorist attacks that have happened in France have become weaponized, politicized by other European politicians and even Donald Trump. France has actually been the site of several attacks, from the Charlie Hebdo attack to the Bataclan concert attack in 2015. Are those attacks overblown, or does France really have a situation where the concerns of immigration are legitimate, given that it has become the focus of these sorts of attacks?
I think that France has a terrorism problem, and I think it needs to be taken very seriously. But what's disturbing about the discourse around this is that politicians like Le Pen and her counterparts in other European countries have very effectively conflated terrorists with refugees. And what they have done, especially during the refugee crisis of 2015, is in the public mind, they conflated refugees who were desperately fleeing from ISIS in Syria with terrorists in Europe who were committing crimes in the name of ISIS. And once that conflation took hold in the minds of voters, it was a very effective tool to depict all refugees and migrants, and to some extent all Muslims, even those who were French citizens, as terrorists. And so what you see after these terrorist attacks, most of which have been committed by European citizens, not by anyone who had come recently as a refugee, the public starts to believe that incoming refugees pose a threat. And what they've done is they've turned that perceived threat into a way of scapegoating all Muslims for the crimes of a few Muslims. And so the tool that I think drives this entire backlash is the idea of collective punishment of an entire group for the crime of one of its members. And mm-hmm. that is exactly the same kind of logic that was used in Germany in the 1930s. And I'm not saying this is an exact analogy. There hasn't been mass collective punishment of Muslims in Europe, in Western Europe, in recent years. But if you look at the history of Kristallnacht, which was commemorated at the 79th anniversary of Kristallnacht, was commemorated in November, the catalyzing event was the murder of a German diplomat by a young Jewish teenager in Paris in 1938. And that assassination was used by Hitler and Goebbels to foment massive anti-Semitic hysteria and violence. And they pointed to it. The graffiti that was painted on synagogues that were being smashed on Kristallnacht was revenge for the murder of Vom Roth. Vom Roth was the German consular official shot in Paris. So I think when we look back at history, we need to be very careful to see how the mechanics of a backlash work. And the mechanics after terrorist attacks in Europe, the kind of rhetoric you see, for instance, the burkini debate in France in August of 2016, the stated rationale for banning modest swimwear that some Muslim women were wearing to the beach was that there had just been a terrorist attack in Nice, and that any wearing of burkinis was an expression of terrorist affiliation, which of course was ridiculous, but you can see how the logic is operating. And I think that that's very dangerous, because essentially you're punishing an entire group for the crime of someone who happens to share the same religion and otherwise has absolutely nothing to to do with the people who are being punished.
There are parallels to the US as well. A lot of the attacks that we've seen here, and there haven't been that many, but of course they get amplified and politicized when the perpetrator is brown skinned. But a lot of the attacks have been by people who've been here for a long time and have been radicalized online. That's happening in Europe as well. People who are disaffected from communities with an immigrant background, but might have been born and raised in those countries and feeling oppressed in those countries, and for whatever reason, doing the wrong thing, lashing out with violence, and then that being used to then punish collectively brown-skinned people. Sasha, I want to ask you a question that often sort of occurs to me whenever I think about how white supremacists justify their actions, this idea of purity and whiteness as being untainted by non-white blood. Because we live in a globalized world today, because we've already had quite a bit of mixing, if you will, in our societies historically and currently, how do those people who defend whiteness even define whiteness? If you lined up a number of photographs of light-skinned brown folks, Turks or even people from India or southern Italy or Latin America, and asked them, are these white people? A lot of white supremacists might say yes, but then you share the names and accents and suddenly they're not white. How do they define white? It makes no sense to say, whiteness is something concrete, because it isn't. And so many people have non-white ancestry that they might just not be willing to confront.
I think it's much more a question of power than actual ancestry. I think if you look at a lot of these groups, what they're actually anxious about and what they're actually trying to protect is dominance and power. And they feel, as a group, that in this country, in the United States, the dominance of white Christians in the society is waning, both in demographic numbers and until the Trump administration in terms of political power. And I think in Europe, it's still quite entrenched, but there's this demographic anxiety that's been fueled by a lot of best-selling authors who don't see themselves as white supremacists, but who are fueling the anxieties and the rhetoric of white nationalist groups in Europe. And they're basically saying, yes, Muslims might only be 5 or 10% of the population in our country now, but they're outbreeding us. And that in 10 or 20 years, there'll be so many of them that they'll start to change our societies. We won't be speaking our native languages anymore. They'll be taking over. And this sort of ignores most of the demographic data on how immigrant groups that have higher birth rates tend to converge with the local population after a generation or so because of housing costs and other really mundane things. But it nevertheless has gotten across, and it's sort of fueled this fear that whites in Europe, who remain an overwhelming majority, are somehow going to become a minority tomorrow. And that fear of small numbers is a very powerful thing. And I think it resonates politically, and it's taken hold in the last few years, especially with the arrival of large numbers of refugees, in a way that has propelled a lot of these politicians to power or propelled their ideas to power. Because I don't think they really have to win elections if their ideas take hold broadly. They've already won to some degree.
And at the same time, when they say, often the ideas are couched in euphemisms. So the French will talk about burkinis not being a part of French culture. But of course, all cultures are amalgams of previous cultures. All cultures are, end up evolving. And what you end up finding when you peel away the layers is a fear of people who are not like you. And that's something that It's hard for a lot of Europeans to admit, and even Americans, white Americans maybe, to admit that what you're really scared of isn't terrorism. What you're really scared of is the fact that that person who looks different from you might want equality, might want to be treated just as equal as you. And that's something that Europe has to grapple with, because it has for years, since especially World War II, promoted this idea of openness and democracy and human rights and liberalism until those values were tested in a real mm-hmm. way, right?
Yeah, and I think you raise a couple of important points. I think the U.S. has generally done better in promoting a shared civic sense of identity. And if there's a mainstream American nationalism, it tends to be more inclusive and more of a civic nationalism than an ethnic nationalism, for all of the United States problems pre-Trump, absolutely. Yeah. And what we've seen in the last year and a half is a resurgence of this white nationalist sentiment that was simmering beneath the surface. I don't think it ever really went away, but it did get sidelined for a while. And I think the Trump campaign really touched on the Trump campaign really pushed the buttons of certain voters and sort of activated these latent sentiments and resentments and played upon ethnic identity rather than other shared identities, whether class identities or regional identities, and activated something that had been dormant for a while. And in Europe, by contrast, I think that there's still a very strong form of ethnic nationalism in a lot of these countries, and that there hasn't been a really strong, inclusive sense of civic identity. So you've talked about France. If you look at France, one of the things that is always brought up by people who are angry about Muslims, whether it's praying in the streets or whether it's wearing burkinis to the beach, and they'll say, we are a secular country and we have this hallowed notion of secularism, and they are publicly displaying their religion. But the way that gets used now in public debate is very targeted at one specific group. No one's saying that Catholic nuns shouldn't have their heads covered when they go to the beach. No one's saying that Orthodox Jewish women who want to go swimming in some form of modest swimwear or wear a wig over their natural hair should be punished. It's very much targeted at Muslims. And so there's this pretense of neutrality, but in fact, what should be a neutral law is not being applied neutrally.
And just here, just as here in the U.S., this idea of religious freedom applies basically to Christians, when it's being pushed by white elites, and not to Muslims. When Muslims might ask about religious freedom, suddenly it's terrorism.
And it's much, much stronger. That sort of backlash in Europe is much, much stronger. Mm-hmm. Even when it comes to things like halal meat or even kosher meat in some places, there's pushback from these far right parties and saying, why should we even offer an option of halal meat in our schools? Why should we even observe Eid or Yom Kippur as a public holiday? There's total resistance to that. I just wanted to say one other thing, Sonali, going back to an interesting question you asked earlier, and we sort of went off in a different direction. You mentioned how young, angry men, especially of with immigrant roots, have been drawn to terrorist and extremist groups in Europe. And I think that's a very important point. And I would argue that these white nationalist groups and Islamic fundamentalist groups are actually feeding off of each other, and they use each other as recruiting tools. So one of the things that you see, for instance, with violent Islamist extremist groups in Europe trying to recruit disillusioned young men who are citizens, and some young women too, but mostly men who are citizens of EU countries, they'll say, you will never be accepted in this country. Everyone hates you. They hate your religion. They're racist, and you have no chance here, so you should come with us. And some of those people have gone off to Syria or Afghanistan to fight with extremist groups like ISIS. And on the other side of it, you see these young white nationalist types being recruited to extremist anti-immigrant groups that sometimes attack migrants and refugees or the places where they live. And the argument is similar. It's that these people are coming to take over your society. Everything you know and love will never be the same, and you need to come with us. And the respective recruiters sort of use the most extreme on each side to recruit people to their cause. And I think it becomes this sort of vicious cycle where everyone becomes more and more polarized. And that's why it's so dangerous when mainstream politicians are saying hateful things in the public sphere. If you look at Holland, for instance, a politician like like Geert Wilders, who won about 15% of the national vote, his main slogan was de-Islamize now. And he referred to Moroccan Dutch people as scum during the campaign. And so when you have that kind of rhetoric out in the open, it's exactly what enables these extremist groups to draw some people in their direction to recruit these disillusioned, angry young men.
So essentially, fundamentalists have a lot more in common with each other, even when they're coming at it with different skin tones or religious backgrounds or accents than they do with the rest of the public.
You mentioned how there's this nostalgic vision of a pure white, pure-blooded Europe. If you look at some of these Islamist fundamentalist groups, they also have a nostalgic vision of a medieval form of Islam that's unpolluted by any sort of foreign blood or foreign ideas. It's very, very similar. They hate each other, but they sound exactly the same when you get down to the words and ideologies.
Meanwhile, mainstream Muslims have tried really hard to separate themselves from these extremist forces and say that they are against it. And even mainstream Europeans have rejected anti-immigrant sentiment. And I think that's important to talk about. And I want to get to that in just a minute. But going back to the conversation around religious targeting, there's also this issue of free speech, which has become a big flashpoint here in the U.S. because a lot of white supremacist, racist messages are being promoted within the framework of free speech. And in Europe, you can go back in recent history and look at what happened in 2006 with the Danish anti-Muslim cartoons that poked fun at the Prophet Muhammad. And you write about that in your book. And they also say, well, you know, we have our right to free speech, and then use the backlash from Muslims against it as a way to say that Muslims are against free speech or to demonize all Muslims. How important was that moment in Europe's history, the Danish cartoon controversy?
I think it's very important, and my view on this may differ from yours or some of your listeners. I think it's very important to defend free speech, but also to recognize the way that it's being manipulated by some of these groups. So I, as offensive as I found the Danish cartoons myself, I think that the artists and editors who published those cartoons had a right to do so, and that the appropriate response was to push back, to either boycott the newspaper, to counter by publishing other cartoons, to have a very vocal public debate and push back against the offensive ideas. And I think the same goes for the sorts of things that we're seeing now. When you have Richard Spencer coming to speak at the University of Florida, as he did a few weeks ago in November or October of 2017, there was a massive counter protest. There was a lot of talk about no platforming. I think the most effective way to challenge someone like Richard Spencer, who actually has no idea what he's talking about most of the time, is to get in his face and argue. And there's actually a perfect example of this. The Black British journalist Gary Young from The Guardian made a documentary recently about white nationalists in the US. And he went and interviewed Spencer at one of these speeches and one of these sort of controversies that he set off. And he exposed him as a completely incompetent, historically illiterate liar. And he did it on television. It was broadcast in the UK. And that is far more effective, I think, than going and saying, no platform, don't let this person speak. Because exposing the fallacy of these arguments, to me, is much, much more important.
And just as a counterpoint to that, I think a lot of what counter-protesters argue is that universities spend and cities are spending precious dollars, millions of dollars, to protect these free speech rights of these white supremacists. That is money that should be going to much more constructive things, just so these white nationalists can create a spectacle. And in some cases, these white supremacists are also openly outing undocumented immigrants and actually putting people in real danger. And that is, of course, as in Charlottesville, we had someone actually die and a lot of people injured because these people were protected, even at that point, by the likes of the ACLU. Since then, the ACLU has sort of decided not to protect the free speech rights of a group that promotes violence. So there's room for debate there.
There is. And I mean, I think that, you know, one of the other issues that happened recently is you saw protests against ACLU lawyers and speakers at universities because they have defended neo-Nazis, because they have defended extremist groups. I would argue that the ACLU is one of the most valuable institutions in the United States and one of the few things in this day and age standing between our liberal democratic values and the corruption of those values by the Trump administration. So I would say, even when you disagree with the ACLU, remember what they are standing for on principle and remember what they're defending, because those things could be turned against the left, as they have been in the past, very easily. And then you want the ACLU in your corner. So I defend organizations like that. What I would say, though, and going back to the Danish question that you began with, is there are groups in Denmark today that pass themselves off as press freedom or freedom of speech groups, but in fact, their primary agenda is targeting Muslims and going after Muslims and denouncing Muslims. And some of these groups have far-right politicians and left-wing cartoonists and journalists in them, and they call themselves the Press Freedom Association. But in fact, their primary objective is to go after Muslims, to humiliate Muslims, and that is not free speech or a defense of free speech. And they have very little to say, for instance, when far-right groups go over the edge and start doing objectionable things. So again, it's another example of this false neutrality. As we were talking about with the burkini debate in France, everyone says, oh, we're defending secularism by keeping Muslim women from going to the beach in their preferred swimwear. And in Denmark, you see the same thing. They say, oh, we're defending liberal values by publishing cartoons that humiliate Muslims. But again, when white supremacist groups, white nationalist groups in Europe start to attack or go after minority groups, they have very little to say. And so their agenda is quite one-sided and quite political. And I think that they need to be called out on that.
Sasha, finally, I want to end our conversation with a discussion about how politicians who do fuel the scapegoating of immigrants and refugees are often obscuring a bigger problem in society that is impacting Europeans, Americans of all stripes, and that is that we do have a massive failure of neoliberal capitalism in Europe, in the US, all over the world, where the have-nots get fewer and fewer things, fewer and fewer jobs, wages, freedoms to have, economic freedoms, etc. And the haves are pointing to the immigrants, say they're the ones who are taking away your jobs rather than big corporations. And how important is it to sort of refocus the conversation, especially when you have working class Europeans and Americans who feel that they're going to get back some power by being anti-immigrant and racist?
Yeah, it's an old story. It's a method of political mobilization that's been used very effectively before across the world. And I find it very disturbing. And it's not just Europe and the US. I mean, one other place that I spent time in researching for my book was South Africa, where you now have a violent xenophobic backlash by Black South Africans against African immigrants from other countries like Zimbabwe and Mozambique and Congo. And there have been killings of Somalis in South Africa. There have been all sorts of violent incidents, forced evictions, and it's happening in a country that many across the world see as a sort of poster child of liberal democratic transition from the horrors of apartheid to a democratic era. But in a country like that, you have real nasty violence against immigrants who happen to be of the same skin color, but they're coming from another place. And it's competition for jobs and the failures of the South African government to live up to its promises and create economic equality. So I want to make the point that it happens in other places too. But going back to Europe and the United States, yes, you made an important point. And I think that one of the things that gets overlooked is how far-right parties have used economic anxieties to mobilize voters. They've always been anti-immigrant. They've always been xenophobic. And if you look back to the 80s and 90s, when a lot of these parties started to take root and build a following, they were much more neoliberal and free market in their economic orientation and totally xenophobic when it came to immigration. And at some point around 2000 and really in the last decade, many of them realized that that wasn't a winning formula. And what they did is they started to depict themselves as more socialist than the socialists when it came to economic policy. And they defended the welfare state in places like Denmark and France and Holland. Marine Le Pen won over 50% in parts of France that used to vote for the Communist Party. I mean, let that sink in for a minute. This, districts in northern and eastern France that were staunchly communist and socialist for decades voted more than 50% for Le Pen. The Danish People's Party has done the same thing, luring voters away from the Social Democrats by saying, we'll defend your welfare state and your child care and your health care and your free secondary education, but for us and for no one else. It's a nativist defense of the welfare state. And so that's been very effective. And Trump tried to do the same thing in 2016, going into places like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania and targeting working class union households that tended to vote Democratic for generations and argue that he was going to bring their jobs back, essentially. So he departed from the Republican orthodoxy on lower taxes and pure free market economics and tried to lure some of these voters. And of course, he hasn't governed that way. He's thrown it all out of the window and appointed all sorts of Wall Street figures to his cabinet who are doing nothing to help these people's economic interests. But as a matter of campaign rhetoric, Trump did the same thing that these far-right parties in Europe did so effectively, and I think it worked for him in a lot of those Midwestern states.
Well, Sasha, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and wish you the best of luck with your book. Are there any websites you'd like to give out?
I'll just restate the title. It's Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. You can buy it from local independent bookstores, preferably, but otherwise it's available on the Hachette Publishers site, IndieBound, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, whatever you prefer, and I hope people enjoy the book.
And I'll confess to you at the very last minute that I was one of the reasons I gravitated towards your book was because the title of your book was something that was once said to me in the wake of the September 11th attacks, almost word for word, and it's an old story. Sasha, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
My guest is Sasha Polakow-Suransky. He is an Open Society Foundations Fellow, was an op-ed editor at the New York Times, senior editor at Foreign Affairs. We've been discussing his new book, Go Back to Where You Came From, The Backlash Against Immigration and the Fate of Western Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.